Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live once again and taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith you'd like to raise in the coming hour, we have just that long to talk and you may want to call early to make sure we can get to your question before the hour runs out. If you don't have a question but you have an alternate viewpoint that you would like to express or defend, feel free to do so. We'd be glad to talk to you. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to be on the program today, we have some lines open right now. We're going to talk, first of all, to Michael from Live Oak, California. Michael, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear you today, as always.
Mm-hmm.
So last night on Coast to Coast AM, which is a nationally syndicated talk show, I'm sure you've heard of it.
Of course.
George Norrie had on a guest, Jeffrey something, I can't remember his last name, but he is an author and a former Pentecostal minister, and he's written several books, but the book that he was talking about last night was a critique of Paul. He said that there's a view out there that Paul was actually teaching that he had taken the message of Jesus and changed it.
Uh-huh.
And he said that Thomas Jefferson actually wrote something to that effect. I was wondering, are you aware of that?
Well, I'm certainly aware of people who think that. That's not an unusual view for people to take who, in my understanding, they misunderstand Jesus and they misunderstand Paul. I've heard it often said that Jesus taught one thing and Paul taught another,
mm-hmm.
and that Paul, you know, maybe deliberately corrupted the Christian message. But I don't believe that, I don't think Paul taught anything differently than Jesus did. And I know there's people out there listening right now who probably think he did, and I'd be glad to have them call and tell me what they think.
Well,
Paul taught differently.
Are you aware of the, I don't know if it was a book or a passage in something that Jefferson had written, but are you aware of that?
Well, Jefferson, first of all, Jefferson wasn't a Christian, and he didn't believe, for example, in miracles, which means, of course, he wouldn't believe in the miraculous conversion of Paul. But he actually put together his own gospels, omitting the miracles, because he felt like the story of Jesus was a great story, but he didn't believe in miracles.
All right. So
Jefferson is not really any kind of an authority on the Bible. He's just a guy who found some things in the Bible objectionable to his own worldview, and so he removed them.
Was he a deist?
I understand him to have been a deist, yes. That is at least what he's usually said to be. You know, a lot of people say that most of the founding fathers were deists, and then other people show up and say, no, here's what they said, they were really Christians and so forth. But certainly some of the founding fathers were deists and were not Christians. And Jefferson would be one of them, I think, and Ben Franklin would be another. Very intelligent men, as there are many intelligent men who are not Christians today, but they're not authorities on such things as on whether Paul, you know, taught something different than the Gospels. You see, the only way we know what Paul taught is from his own letters. And his letters affirm all the main points that Jesus affirmed. So I don't really know why anyone would say he changed things.
Well, I wish I had taken notes or I could find a copy of the book. But my friend called me last night. She said, you have to listen to this. It's really interesting. And she can get the name of his last name from the website, but one of the things that he said was Jesus didn't teach originally the doctrine of original sin. He actually taught that we all have the divine seed, and he said that whole thing about being sinners and so forth, so that came from Paul. That was a later addition or modification or alteration of Christ's message.
Let me read to you what Christ actually said.
All right.
In the Gospel of Mark, which is considered to be the earliest of the Gospels by most scholars, Christian and non-Christians tend to think that Mark was the earliest of the Gospels. And Jesus said in Mark chapter 7, verse 15, there's nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him, but the things which come out of him, those are the things which defile the man. Now, in Matthew's parallel, there's some additional information. Jesus goes on to say, it's about the same. I'm sorry, it's worded a little differently, but it's not really. Let me see. I'm looking for the list of things. Here we go. Verse 20, he said, and he said, what comes out of a man, that defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile a man. Now, Jesus said that these are the things that come out of a heart of a man. They're not the only things that come out, but they do come out. I mean, there are, every man certainly has had some of the things on that laundry list in his life. And so I would say that to say that Jesus didn't teach that men were sinners would be to misrepresent Jesus in at least two of the Gospels.
As a non-Christian, you know, somebody was brought up Jewish, my understanding of the Christian teaching that categorically mankind is sinful. It's a basic condition of being a human being, and this guy last night was saying that Jesus actually taught that man is potentially divine, that he's inherently good at his core, just there are these coverings, these veils of
I'd be interested in knowing which verses in the Gospels he's referring to. I don't know of any place in the Bible where Jesus taught anything remotely like that. Actually, if we were looking for material in the Bible that would perhaps be able to be pressed into the service of a teaching that man can become godlike, I'd say Paul's writings are the best for that. I mean, Paul said in 2 Corinthians 3:18 that we all, with unveiled faces, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being changed from glory to glory into that same image, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. I mean, Paul indicated that we do become Christ-like as we continue to grow as Christians. In Galatians 4:19, he said, oh, my little children, who were his converts, he said, how I travail again in childbirth for you until Christ is formed in you. There's plenty of references to people becoming Christ-like or God-like. Paul in Ephesians 5:1 said, be imitators of God as dear children. So we have actually more statements from Paul of that type than we have from Jesus. I'm not even sure that we have any from Jesus, except perhaps we might take Luke 6, I think it's verse 40, where he said, a disciple is not above his master, but he that is fully trained shall be even as his master. So one could argue that Jesus is saying there that once his disciples are fully trained, they'll be like him. But Paul said it numerous times. So I don't know why someone would say that Paul had a different view on such things than Jesus.
Did Jesus at one point say that human beings are like gods, or with a small g?
Well, he's probably thinking of a statement Jesus made in John chapter 10. And if he thinks Jesus was saying that, then he's it's a good thing he's not a minister anymore, because he doesn't read the Bible very carefully. Jesus said, I and my Father are one. And the Jews, actually, who opposed him, took up stones to stone him. And he said, well, I've done many good works among you. For which of these good works do you stone me? And they said, we're not stoning you for a good work. We're stoning you for blasphemy, because you, being a man, have made yourself God. And he said, is it not written in your law? And then he quotes from Psalm 82, where it says, I said you are gods. Psalm 82, verse 6 says, I said you are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High, but you shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. Now, that's not in the teaching of Jesus. That's in the Psalms, in the Old Testament. But Jesus quoted it, not in order to teach something from it, but in order to show his critics that they were inconsistent. They were stoning him because of his words that he said he was the Son of God. And he said, well, your own Bible says to certain people, you are gods. You know what? You're going to go stone the right guy who wrote the Psalms? Jesus was not giving a teaching about people being gods, and certainly the last thing he would be teaching on that occasion would be that those who were holding stones, murderously wanting to stone him, would that he be telling them that they are gods.
All right. And
he, in fact, he told them two chapters earlier, they're children of the devil, in John 8:44. So to take a lot of New Age people who say we're all divine do take that statement of John in John chapter 10 there, where Jesus said, I said you are gods, and they take it out of context to make it as if Jesus is teaching that. He's not. He's quoting something from their own Bible. He says, your own Bible says this, and why are you going to, you know, if your Bible calls people gods, why would you stone me when I call myself the Son of God? So he's not at all teaching anything about people being gods. He's saying the words of your own scriptures don't seem to offend you. Why do my words offend you, which are seemingly less blasphemous than those?
Well, what about the passage, and I don't remember where it is, where something about if you had faith, you could move mountains, but you can do a lot more than that. You can do more than I have done. If you had faith, and I'm so sorry.
Yeah, in John chapter 14 in the upper room, Jesus said, he that believes in me, the works that I do, he shall do also, and greater works shall he do because he believes in me. Yeah, that's in John 14, verse, looks like it's 12. Yeah, so Jesus said that the disciples would actually do a greater work than what he did. And in a sense, that's exactly true. I mean, Jesus started a movement and left 11 faithful followers behind. That's not that might not be regarded as extremely successful work that he did. Didn't have much to show for it. But the disciples, on the other hand, continued his work and expanded it far more than he did. And now there are, there's a billion people or more who claim to be Christians.
Well, just in listening to this guy last night, and he still respects the main body of Christianity and Catholicism, but he said there's been so much that has happened in politics, and from listening to you over the years, I know.
Was this man Bart Ehrman by any chance?
No, it was Jeffrey something. I'll try.
Okay.
And when I see you in mail, hopefully have gotten a name. But he not too long ago stepped down from being a Pentecostal minister after researching.
Yeah, Bart Ehrman wasn't a Pentecostal, I don't think. He was an evangelical. But he says the same kind of things. Lots of people who leave Christianity tend to make their former relationship with Christianity a selling point in their book writing career against Christianity. But you know what? You still got to check them out. You got to check their arguments out and say, okay, anyone can write a book and say something, but let's look. Let's look at what Jesus said. Let's look at what Paul said. And if someone wants to say that Paul said something or taught something different than what Jesus taught, or let's say contrary to what Jesus taught, let's see where the passages are, and let's see if that really is true. You know, if someone says that Jesus said everybody's got a spark of the divine in them, and they quote John 10 where he said, I said you are gods, that person is showing that he really doesn't read the Bible very carefully. He's just looking for words that sound like what he wants to hear. And people do that a lot, but Bible students don't do that. And that's why it's more important to study the Bible than to just casually read over it without understanding half of it. See,
was there an early theologian or someone who was critical or suspicious of Paul? Did this go way back? This type of
Marcion, the Marcionite cult didn't like Paul.
I take that back.
No, that's the opposite. They did like Paul. They didn't like anything else but Paul. So, there was a group that didn't like Paul. Probably the Ebionites, I'm not sure, but the Ebionites probably didn't like Paul. But the Marcionites didn't like anybody but Paul. So, there's all kinds out there.
Did they in some way put Paul above Jesus?
Nobody that I know of put Paul above Jesus. No.
All right. Nothing would surprise me.
Right. Well, in the Corinthian church, there were some who were saying, I am of Paul. And others were saying, I'm of Peter. And some were saying, I'm of Apollos. And some were saying, I'm of Christ. One could argue that the ones who are saying anything other than I am of Christ, let's say those who said, I am of Paul, instead of saying they were of Christ, might be putting Paul above Christ. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's what they intended. I think they were just saying that as followers of Christ, we like Paul best among the teachers. So I don't think they were putting Paul above Christ. Listen, Michael, we've got other calls to take. And
all right, Steve, I really appreciate it. That was helpful, as always.
All right, thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
All right, good talking to you again. All right, our next caller is Stephen from Bellevue, Washington. And we now have a line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I was listening to a minister from the Midwest. I know you're somewhat familiar with him. I don't know if I need to say his name or not. But anyway, he's been doing a series on Revelation, and he's generally kind of coming from a spiritualized point of view. And he's got a lot of good things to say, but he mentioned something about the 144,000 that I'd never heard before, and I was wondering if you might be able to confirm, deny, or say I don't know either. But
okay,
he said that in the Jewish tradition, there was an idea of an army of the Messiah that numbered 144,000, and so that John and Jesus were using that picture because it was familiar to the Jews at the time of an army of the Messiah. But I've tried to find some information about Jewish point of view about an army of the Messiah and stuff like that, and I can't find anything. I just was wondering if you had heard that. And this fellow is a real scholar. I know he's got a PhD from Yale in philosophy and things like that. But so I know he can research things. So I just was wondering if you had heard that too.
Well, he could be right. I have never heard that from any of the commentaries I've read.
Okay.
I will tell you. Where I would expect to find it, if it is true, would be in Gregory Beale's commentary. Gregory Beale's commentary on Revelation, it's a real massive work. I think it's about 800 pages or something like that. And he delves into, you know, all the Jewish traditions and things like that that might be alluded to in Revelation. It's very scholarly, and it's kind of, it's probably one of the most highly respected commentaries on Revelation among evangelicals. I would think that if that claim is true, then it probably is, I imagine that Gregory Beale's commentary would contain it. I have his commentary, but I don't remember reading that, and I haven't read every word of his commentary, by the way.
Right.
But
it's
the kind of thing that I would not think he would omit.
Uh-huh. It's just a very interesting picture. I myself, when I read that, I'm reminded of the censuses taken in the Old Testament where they number basically the army, especially when they first came out, they numbered the army so many thousands in this tribe and so many thousands in that tribe. And
right.
It just sort of reminded, you know, as I'm sort of drawn back to that picture in the Old Testament when I read this numbering, so many from this tribe, so many from that tribe. Of course, it's very spiritualized by the round number of 12,000 from each tribe.
Yeah, it seems like the numbers are symbolic more than real, but no doubt it is saying something that really does refer to multiplied thousands from each tribe. Now, to refer to them as the army of the Messiah, I would think, although I'm not sure, but if the rabbis did have a tradition like that, they were probably thinking of a conventional army, you know, with weapons and things like that. If Revelation happened to be alluding to such a Jewish tradition, if there is such, I'm sure that it would be intending to understand them as a spiritual army in a spiritual battle.
That's the application this teacher was making, and he's I think you would say, and he would admit that he's a very strong pacifist, and he's spiritualizing a lot of this stuff in terms of all these bloody battles being talked about in a spiritual way, the battle that Christ has done on the cross and things like that.
Is this Gregory Boyd?
Yeah, it is.
Uh-huh. Well, I haven't read what he says on that, but I would trust him.
Yeah, he's doing a series on Revelation right now on his website. The church's website has current sermons, so I don't know if you're interested in that, but you could listen to those or whatever. And
cool.
I think they also have them in contextual or written out form. So.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I heard that. I was really curious to see hear what he was going to have to say, because just in general, he seems to have a real strong distaste for any kind of association of Jesus with any kind of violent activity.
Right.
And so that perspective can shade your meaning or shade, you know, cause you to make interpretations that may not be actually accurate. But
yeah, well, I think you know, if he's got the truth there, and I wouldn't expect him to say it if he didn't, because I would trust his integrity. Then I would say that if that's the case, then the 144,000 imagery of an army would be suggesting a spiritual army, of course.
Right, but
Gregory Boyd goes further, and even looking in the Old Testament passages where God kills people or where he commands Israel to do violent things, I think he's a little squeamish about those. And
right.
I think he might kind of explain some of those away in a way that I would not. But for the most part, I would take him to be an honest scholar, and that he wouldn't probably give some kind of a historical reference if it wasn't true.
Right. Yeah, I've heard you say that you hear these things and you kind of want to check them out because, you know, where did the pastor get that, or where did the teacher get
that?
Yeah,
people can say anything, obviously. Right. You want to look it up and see.
Right, yeah. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
Okay, Stephen, good talking to you. Thanks for your call.
Yeah. Yeah, bye-bye.
All right. If you'd like to be on the program, the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to be on The Narrow Path. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast, and my name is Steve Gregg. Our lines are open right now, so you can get through. 1-800-438-5090. John wrote to me from somewhere, I don't know where he listens, but he says, "Hello, Steve. I have heard many times from my pastor and radio pastors that during the 3 days between Jesus' death and resurrection, he went to hell and fought with the devil for the keys of the kingdom. I don't find compelling reason to believe it from scriptures. I believe Jesus defeated the devil at the cross, but I'd like to know your thoughts on it as well. Thanks for your time." Signed, John. Well, my own thoughts are that this depiction of Christ going down to Hades and fighting with the devil to get the keys of death and Hades is a pretty over-dramatized imaginary scenario based on a couple of things. One is that it says of Jesus in Psalm 16 that his soul was not left in Hades. Okay, so the assumption is that he went down to Hades when he died, and of course everyone who died went to Hades in those days. That's what Hades was, the place dead people go. But whether people in Hades were conscious or not, and whether they met up with the devil or not, are different questions that would have to be answered. The Bible certainly does not ever suggest that Jesus encountered the devil in Hades or fought with him. But the other passage that they use is in Revelation 1, where Jesus says in passing, as he's talking about himself, he says, "I have the keys of death and Hades." Now, someone with a good imagination put together in their mind a scenario. Jesus went down to Hades, and now he has the keys of death and Hades. Now, it does say elsewhere in Hebrews chapter 2 that Satan was the one who had the power of death, and so they imagine he must have secured them from Satan. Now, I think their imagination runs even further wild when they say, well, Satan certainly wouldn't give them up without a fight, so he must have had to wrestle them from Satan. There must have been some conflict going on between Jesus and the devil in Hades, and Jesus succeeded to get those keys and came out with them. This way of describing it is all imaginary. There's nothing in the Bible that says that. The Bible does not say that Jesus encountered the devil in Hades or anything like that. It does, however, teach that Jesus, through his death, did conquer the forces of darkness. Now, we don't read that he encountered them down in Hades and had a fight with them down there, but his death and resurrection itself was the conquest of the forces of darkness. It says that in Colossians 2:15. It says that in Hebrews 2:14. And it is stated or implied a number of other places. So, no, I wouldn't go along with this dramatic portrayal that preachers often use of Jesus having some kind of a conflict with the devil down in Hades. Although I wouldn't say it couldn't have happened. I'm just saying there's nothing, that's not coming from the Bible. That's coming from somebody's vivid imagination. All right, let's talk to John from Las Vegas, Nevada. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. The question I have is, in the Old Testament, I remember reading about David and how he did a census and he numbered the people. Yep. And God was angry with him for doing that. Maybe you could explain to me why God was mad and like what it was about.
Boy,
I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, John. I really do wish that I could explain to you why God was mad about that. The passage is very unusual in that David did something which is never actually forbidden anywhere in Scripture. He took a census of the people. Now, even Joab, who was not a very godly man, knew that was the wrong thing. Joab was his chief general, and when he told Joab, I want you to go take a census, Joab objected to it on some kind of moral grounds that this was the wrong thing for David to do, and David overrode him, said, no, do it anyway. And then when David did it, God was angry at him and sent a plague. Now, this is a very perplexing story, and it's possible someone has a better answer than I do, but I haven't found it yet. I certainly have looked for it. Some people think what was wrong was David's heart, that he shouldn't, that he was being proud and wanted to puff up his ego by knowing the size of the nation that he was ruling over. Some feel that he was starting to want to trust in military strength instead of in God, and therefore he was taking a census preparatory to rallying an army so that he'd be, you know, secure when he had formerly, as the Psalms tell us, been secure in God. And David himself had said, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. So there are guesses that people have made that what David was doing wrong wasn't so much a wrong thing as having a wrong reason or wrong motivation. So some think it's David's pride. Some think it was his decision to trust in armies rather than in God, and that, you know, to replace God in his trust with military might or whatever. We don't have information about that. We're not told why David wanted to do that. And all we can say is it was wrong. And this is just something that the authors of Scripture left out. That is, why is this wrong? You see, taking a census itself is not a wrong thing. God told Moses to take censuses more than once. Once when they first came out of Egypt and once just before they entered the Promised Land, they were to take a census of the people. So, you know, it's not like it's immoral or wrong or unethical or something bad to take a census of the people of Israel. But for some reason, it was the wrong thing for David to do on that occasion. And I'd love to be able to explain it to you, but I would have to have more information than we're given. My guess is there must have been something going on in David's heart that was wrong and displeasing to God, and his reasons for wanting to take the census must have been, unworthy motivations, and so God disapproved of it. You see, even if you do a good thing, but you do it for bad motivations, it becomes a bad thing. Now, taking a census in Israel probably by itself is neither good nor bad. It's probably a neutral thing. But even if it was a good thing, if you do it for a bad reason, it's bad. The Proverbs say several times, even the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord. Now, sacrifice is something you offer to God as an act of worship. Certainly not a bad thing, but if the wicked do it, that is, if they're wickedly motivated. In fact, it says about three times, one of the Proverbs says, especially when it's done with wicked intent. So even offering worship to God is an abomination to him if it's offered with wrong motivation. And that could be really what lies behind God's disapproval of David's action. If that isn't, then I have never heard, another explanation that is very satisfying. I wish I could do better than that, but we'd have to have more information available than is available. So I apologize for my inability there to really sort that out well for you. Let's talk to Brad from Kuski, Idaho. Hi, Brad.
On that same story, wasn't there one tribe that did not get any punishment?
No, I don't remember that. I don't remember that. The plague, I don't think, covered the whole land. So there probably were some of the tribes that were out of its range. But I don't remember there being a particular tribe that was spared.
Okay. I thought that there was. And I thought it was because that particular tribe refused to be numbered.
No, so I don't recall that being so. I mean, okay. If it is, it's skipping from my memory. Yeah.
Gotcha. I was going to call you last week, but then when you talked about Thomas Jefferson, I thought, that's a good time, especially since you had open phones. Now, my question is, do you think God, based on your, extensive study, would rather have a person in heaven who got there through his volition, or would he rather have an aborted baby in heaven?
I think God would rather have everybody in heaven.
Okay, I kind of think that God wants heaven more than anything else to be filled up with people who are there on their volition, rather than, and I think that's why God is so adamant about justice, because he doesn't want a bunch of dead babies. He doesn't want a bunch of brain-damaged people. He wants healthy people. Anyway, I just want to hear your opinion on that, and I gave you mine. Real quick on Thomas Jefferson, it seems to me that he was a Christian. And I guess my question to you is, it's in the many years I've listened to you, it seems that you're quick to judge a historical figure but not a current figure, and I have the exact opposite approach. I will take current preachers and say, that man is a wolf in sheep's clothing. What do you think about that in our two different approaches? Like, I don't even want to name their names because you've actually asked me not to name their names. But there are people who I firmly believe are wolves in sheep's clothing. And I have no guilt conscience by saying this man is. Yet my conscience would bother me to say that Thomas Jefferson was not a Christian since he claimed to be one. And also, here's one other thing about Thomas Jefferson. Have you ever heard, I could say many things about Thomas Jefferson, but here's one. Have you heard that he actually did that Bible? And his idea was to just take out the words, it's kind of like taking a Bible and putting the words of Christ in red. He was attempting to just write in a pamphlet only what he felt was the words of Christ. I think it was John Eidsmo and David Barton that say that that's what Thomas Jefferson was doing there.
Well, both John Eidsmo and David Barton know a whole lot more about the Founding Fathers than I do, and you know a lot more about them than I do. I don't come here as any kind of an expert to answer questions about the Founding Fathers. If I say that Jefferson was not a Christian, I'm only saying what all the educators have always said that I've ever read. I'm not judging it from my intimate knowledge of the man.
Well, you said he was certainly not a Christian. And I
I had always heard that he was not a Christian from Christian and secular sources. So, I haven't done my own research about Thomas Jefferson, and I'm not going to because I'm not that interested. But I,
right.
Yeah, but
so
the truth is, I'm just repeating what I think everybody has said who educates on the subject that I know about. But if John Eidsmo and David Barton say he was a Christian, then I guess they probably have some information I don't have.
Between those two men is they've done a ton of research. And also,
right,
both of those men are actual Christians.
Right.
And so, but now, the thing also about Colin Franklin a deist, he is the man who introduced the legislation to start the Congress out in prayer. He's also the man who instituted a congressional chaplainship. The fruits of that is not deism. So,
well, you might think not. Yeah, I really don't know. I really don't know. Again, I'm going by what the books say, what the educators say. And I've never heard Christian or non-Christian say that Franklin was a Christian. But if he was, he was certainly a disobedient one.
No, I think he was very obedient. Let me just run this by. I know I don't want to take up much time, but he pretended to be somewhat worldly because he was fighting a Revolutionary War. And he knew that he had to infiltrate the secret societies of England. So there are some real veins of defense for Benjamin Franklin, but you have to be willing to look at him. Doesn't mean I know either, Steve, but there are veins of defense for Benjamin Franklin's apparent worldliness. And the main one is England had been taken over by secret societies, and those secret societies were trying to take over America. And Benjamin Franklin entrenched himself in those secret societies so he could fight them and win the war. But
okay.
Anyway,
let me just say, I don't profess to know much of anything outside the mainstream, textbooks about the founding fathers. There may be people who know, I mean, when I say there may be, there certainly are people who know far more than I do about them, because frankly, almost anyone who's studied them would know more than I do about them. I haven't studied them. If I pass along a statement about one of the founding fathers, I'm usually not passing it on as my discovery. I'm passing it on as what I consider to be the mainstream understanding of that person. If a deeper understanding of that person would overthrow that mainstream view, that's fine with me. I don't have anything invested in it.
Well, the main problem with America is we are being majorly lied to, and us Christians really should be wise enough to see through those lies. And I'm talking about mainstream lies like Iraq, whatever, any subject. Well, I'll let you go, Steve. Love you very much.
Okay, Brad, thanks for your call. Good talking to you. All right, our next caller is Ralph from Salinas, California. Ralph, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, sir. My question today, first of all, I like to listen to you because I like to learn about the Bible and the Bible only. I don't like this to government and all that stuff because I don't care. I care about what you do, and you do the Bible. That's so important for us as people that give you money because we want to learn. The reason why we give you get the Narrow Path going is because we want to hear biblical stuff, not government, because I could care less about them. My question is today, sir, is where does it say in the Bible that do not force somebody into the Word of God or the Bible? Do you know any scriptures?
Don't force somebody into it? You mean don't force someone to keep it?
No, don't force somebody, you know, like to just, you know, like a grandmother is forcing her son to, you know, go to church, to read the Bible, to, you know, just force.
Oh, okay. The Bible doesn't forbid that. The Bible says to nurture your children in the, you know, nurture and admonition of the Lord. And therefore, for you to require your children to go to church or to be involved in family devotions and so forth, that's not a wrong thing to do. I would say,
well, no,
though,
but see, that's what's wrong with our society is that, you know, when they're being forced, they push back, and this is why they don't like this relation with God, and that's what he's telling me. And
well,
so,
true. Well, the interesting thing here is that you know, children are forced routinely into secularism at the public schools. I mean, the public schools don't teach them there's a God. They teach them evolution. They teach them secularism. And what's interesting is most of the kids don't rebel against that. But if you are forcing, or someone thinks what you're doing is tantamount to forcing them to be Christians, in many cases, your kids will rebel against that for some reason. Well, they'll push back against that. And I think that's because of the sinful nature. The sinful nature of people does not push back against secularism so much, but it does against God's claims upon us. But what I'd say about this is the Bible does not say it's wrong to require your children to go to church or anything like that. I would say you also have to use wisdom in recognizing if the pressure you're putting on them is driving them away, in which case you might lighten up. I mean, there needs to be more than just saying you have to go to church. I mean, after all, my parents told me I had to go to church. I had to go to church when I was growing up, and I've gone to church ever since. But I was a Christian as a child, and I am still. I don't mind going to church. They made me go to public school, too, and if they hadn't, I wouldn't have gone. I was very rebellious against public school the first 6 years or 5 years or so. I hated going to public school, but I was forced to do that. Why doesn't anyone say it's wrong to force kids to do that? I mean, parents require their young children to do what the parents think is best for them. Going to school is what most parents think is good for their kids. Going to church or Sunday school is what many parents think is good for their children. And there's nothing wrong with parents exposing their children to whatever influences they think they should. But here's the problem. If you're making your kid go to church or read the Bible or something like that, but in other respects, you are not adoring the gospel. But your life doesn't look like a life that they would want, let's say. Yeah. Or you're in a fellowship with Christians that are hypocrites and are, you know, as soon as your kids get old enough to pay attention, which isn't very old, they recognize, hey, these people are no better than anyone else. They're just judgmental and, you know, religious and so forth. I mean, there are factors that make people turn against religion. It usually is not that they had to go to church. But in many cases, it's what they experience at church or in the home, and in the examples they see of Christians is very often what turns them against it. So I think if you're going to make a child go to church, you need to pay attention to the quality of the people that you're forcing that child to associate with there. And if, you know, if you're making the child participate in family devotions, you should make sure that your child sees you and your wife or whatever, whoever's professing to be a Christian in this situation, as somebody who is good, honest, loving, and a good person to be like someday.
What scripture would you give him to give this young man?
I'm sorry, I don't know who the young man is or what he's asking.
This is what he told me. His mom forces them to, you know, to read the Bible and to go to church. And I said, well, you know, you should go, but, you know, he goes, isn't this anything that says something that, you know, you shouldn't force me, that I should do it voluntarily?
Well, how old is this young man?
About 25.
Well, then I don't see how his mother can force him to do anything. Does he live at home?
Yes, he does.
Well, maybe the first step would be to move out, and then he can do what he wants to do. You know, if he's living with his mother, frankly, if you live with your parents after you're old enough to be out, then you can't complain. You can't complain about any of the standards your parents have. This is their home. If they say no one's going to be in this home unless they go to church, no one's going to be in this home unless they read the Bible, well, the child who doesn't want to go to church, who doesn't read the Bible, can say, okay, I'll find somewhere else to live, and that's the way it should go. Too many young people feel like they're entitled to live free at their parents' house when they're old enough to be having children themselves and having their own households, and they complain about the terms that their parents are offering the housing at. I mean, living with your parents when you're old is not an entitlement. If your parents take you in, they have every right to say, these are the terms on which I will let you stay with me. If you don't like these terms, I won't make you stay here.
I hear you, man.
He's got to honor his father and his mother. If he doesn't like Christianity or doesn't want to read the Bible, then he should just tell his parents, you know, folks, you know, I'm just not where you're at. I'm not there anymore. I'm going to move out. I don't want to displease you by not living up to your standards in your home. So I'm going to move out. I'm 25 years old after all.
Yeah, he is old. I couldn't find nothing either. So I just said, you know, you just got to follow your instructions. But I just wanted to hear from you.
All right. Well, that's what I would say.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Ralph, thanks for your call, bro.
Stick with the Bible, please. No political, please.
Okay. Well, the truth is, I don't ever bring up the political things, but we have an open line here. And I make it very clear that the program is essentially for people who have questions about the Bible. And so that's what we get most of the time. But, for example, how did the political thing come up today? Well, Michael from Live Oak heard somebody claim that Jefferson had said, that Paul didn't teach the same thing as Jesus. And he asked what I thought about that. Had I heard that and so forth? So I made an offhand comment about Jefferson, agreeable with what I think the schools usually teach and what I've always read, but I'm not highly educated about Jefferson, nor was it my intention to really speak authoritatively about Jefferson. But then my friend Brad, who often calls up to correct me if I say something that's politically, I'm not going to say politically incorrect because he's not a liberal. He's not politically correct himself, but he's very fascinated with the Founding Fathers and with political things. So, if I say something that doesn't seem to be correct about the Founding Fathers, I can usually expect Brad to give me a call and straighten it out. But at the same time, you're right. I'm not interested in turning this show into a discussion about the Founding Fathers or about politics at all. We have to understand, however, that as Christians, there are questions that people would call political questions that overlap our realm of concern, but not in the same way that many Christians think. For example, obviously Christians have some views about abortion. Christians have some views about homosexuality. Christians have some views about divorce. Christians have some views about lots of things. But our Christian views also have to determine to what degree are those things supposed to be politicized. Now, I'm not answering that question. I'm just saying that's a question that's a separate question. But that, too, is a Christian concern. To what degree are Christians supposed to press for legislation about these subjects? And by contrast, to what degree are we supposed to simply live as a counterculture, observing and keeping the standards that the Bible teaches us, and allowing the non-Christian to go their way until they come to Christ, and, you know, kissing goodbye to our culture, basically. Many Christians are having a hard time living with the fact that our culture is not any longer Christian. It probably never, I mean, the culture used to be Christian in sympathy, at least. But it's not now. It's not now. I mean, wake up. Wake up. We're not living in a Christian country. We're living in a pagan country. We're living in an anti-Christian country. If there's any religion our country likes besides secularism, it seems to be Islam, because they make all kinds of provisions for Islam, and they don't make the same provisions for Christianity. Just wake up. We're not living in a Christian world anymore. And maybe we never were, and we were asleep and thought so. But the point here is, Christians, when it comes to politics, the real question for Christians is, to what degree are we supposed to take the Christian standards we have and push for them to be become the norms of the secular culture? That's a hard answer, because to some degree, Christians should speak up for justice even in the secular world. But to force non-Christians to live like Christians through force of law is a different matter. However, to stand up for non-Christians living maybe not as Christians, but as simply people who are practicing justice, Christians should have a concern about that. If they have concern about the world at all, we should be concerned that justice should prevail. So there are political questions that Christians wrestle with. But I'm not politically, I'm not a political activist. I'm not really particularly politically smart. It's not my field. I have opinions, though. But, of course, if people ask me questions about politics, they're not as likely to get an authoritative answer as if they ask me about the Bible. It used to be, I don't know what happened to this listener, there used to be a listener who'd write to me an angry email after every program whenever political issues came up. It's not me that brought them up. You know, someone else would bring up a political issue, and I'd engage in conversation with them, and I'd take usually a relatively conservative political stance. And this person, I think, must have been a liberal, because every time my show involved any kind of conservative political talk at all, which is very seldom on the program, I got an angry email from this person saying, stick with the subject you know something about, you know, which is good advice. Good advice. However, I usually don't talk about politics per se, unless it is something I know something about. Not that I'm an expert on anything. Okay, let's talk to Pam from Portland, Oregon. Pam, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hey, Steve. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I had the mixed pleasure of watching the movie Noah over the weekend.
Oh, it wasn't even a little bit of a pleasure for me.
Well, the only pleasure that I found was that the scenery was very beautiful in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So that's why I say mixed pleasure.
Well, but you can watch The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and see New Zealand.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. So since you watched the movie, then you can tell me, who are the watchers, and is that an extra biblical concept?
No, it's not. It's not. Some people believe that certain angels fell before the flood,
mm-hmm.
Because they were attracted to earthly women, and it's a certain way they interpret the words at the beginning of Genesis 6, which are capable of another interpretation. But it's in the Jewish apocryphal writings, not part of the Old Testament writings. It teaches that some angels fell and corrupted the world before sin, before the flood, and because of sin, God had to destroy the world. Now, however, in the Kabbalah, from what I understand, and I'm no expert on the Kabbalah either, but I understand that the Kabbalah and I think the Book of Enoch too, both of which are, of course, not biblical books, they do make something out of these more. I think one of them may even call them the Watchers, and it's more of a fictionalization of what some people think may have happened related to this more obscure and unexplained passage in the opening of Genesis 6. I read an article critiquing the movie from the standpoint of someone who knew the Kabbalah, and said, you know, the movie was not following the Bible at all. Of course, I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost nothing that the movie has in common with the Bible, except there's a guy named Noah and a guy named, and some Shem, Ham, and Japheth. That is, the names are the same. Everything else has been changed, including who they were and what they were like.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a flood. So those two things had something in common with the Bible. But everything else about the story was 100% unbiblical.
Mm-hmm.
Not just extra-biblical, but unbiblical.
Yeah.
I mean, the world in the movie was destroyed because people were destroying the world. They were not good environmentalists. Seems strange for God, if he's concerned about saving the world and about the way people are destroying it, that God would himself destroy it with a flood. Seems like there'd be different ways to put people out of the picture and not destroy the world himself.
Definitely.
But, in the movie, no one was dying because of sin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Bible, it's because of violence and sinfulness that the world was destroyed. But the movie, it just didn't have anything in common with the Bible, but it had apparently a lot in common with the Kabbalah.
Mm, the Kabbalah. Okay.
Yeah, the Kabbalah is sort of Jewish mysticism, and it's not biblical.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the other questions I had was in terms of fallen angels mentioned in Jude, is there any connection between Jude and Genesis?
No, not between Jude and Genesis, except maybe by a circuitous route. Jude is referring to some things that are said in the book of Enoch. Now, Enoch is an apocryphal book, not scripture.
Uh-huh.
It dates from maybe a century or two before the time of Christ, if that early. And it is taking material from Genesis and making its own fictional, development of it. And so that's why I say maybe indirectly Jude is related to Genesis via the book of Enoch. But the book of Enoch just gives a human interpretation of what frankly is a mysterious passage in the book of Genesis 6. And Jude's comments about the angels that fell seems to be based upon Enoch because it agrees with it. And Peter made a reference to the fallen angels too in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you saw the movie. Did you stay throughout the whole movie? I know a lot of people left.
I did, but it was difficult. I wanted to see what the outcome was going to be, what the message was going to be of the movie. I knew I'd be asked about it, you know.
Yes.
And so I thought, I wanted to see how they come out, what the message is. And the message is not biblical.
Well, there's also a bit of bait and switch going on in the sense that this movie was advertised on Christian radio.
Oh, that's right. It is bait and switch, very much. And if you saw the trailers, they only showed lines spoken that might agree with the Bible, you
mm-hmm.
know. And they must have really had to comb through the movie to find enough lines in it that could somehow agree with the Bible to put them into a trailer. They definitely were trying to deceive the Christian public. For example, when the angry mob comes against Noah on the trailer, he says, the king says, "You dare to defy me alone?" And, Russell Crowe says, "I'm not alone." And you think, yeah, God's with him. He's not alone. He's got God on his side. In the movie, he's not talking about God. He's talking about the Watchers. He's talking about the Transformers, the rock monsters or whatever, the rock lords or whatever they are. These monsters that are fallen angels, they're the ones who are standing with Noah, and they're the ones he's referring to when he says, "I'm not alone." Obviously, if they showed that much on the trailer, Christians would stick their fingers down their throats and gag as they left and never buy a ticket, which is what we did when we watched the movie. We bought the ticket, but we gagged all the way through if we stayed. But the truth is, they did lie to the public. They said, we take some artistic liberties, but we're trying to stay true to the faith that has inspired millions throughout history. He's talking about the Kabbalah faith, not the Christian faith. But anyway, the movie's awful as far as I'm concerned from a Christian point of view. And I wish I hadn't given them any of my money to get in there, but I felt like I had to be able to review it if people asked. Anyway, thanks for your call, Pam. We're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, we pay the radio time for it. You can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to the website, which is simply thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.